You're listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. For several years now, the levels of mental health and well-being within the UK police have been in decline. Many will argue that this is a result of an ever-increasing workload, a reduction in capacity and experience, underfunding, and a perception that social and mainstream media proactively portray a negative narrative of law enforcement within the UK. Additionally, lenient sentencing, poor organisational practices, and the disproportionate time spent on officers under investigation have contributed to create a perfect storm. In this short series of podcasts, I will be looking at the rising trend of police officers taking their own lives. I will be speaking with a variety of people to put a spotlight on police suicide, the reasons behind it, and hopefully how we can halt its rise. They say it's the punch you don't see that gets you, and that was certainly true in my case, nearly 25 years as a cop, and how could I have been so stupid not to have seen what was fast approaching? Me, Mr. Wellbeing, podcasting for years on the subject, and telling everybody to make sure they looked after themselves. I felt a fraud when it finally happened to me. What did actually happen to me was a mental breakdown, a shed collapse, or as my counsellor kindly suggested, a normal reaction to an abnormal set of circumstances. Why am I telling you this? It's certainly not for sympathy, but simply to share who I am and where I'm coming from, because I fear it will probably happen to somebody else. The best mistakes to learn from, they say, are somebody else's. I personally know of friends in the job who have suffered catastrophic trauma and thankfully have come out the other side. Some only just. My circumstances, I suppose, are quite typical and certainly not on the scale of some. Those circumstances fell into three distinct groups: me, work, and bereavement. The me bit was an unhappy childhood, which with the help of counselling, transpired that love was conditional. Not only was I not heard as a child, I was dismissed. This influenced every relationship and situation I encountered since. The work bit was a little longer in the making, almost 25 years in fact. Looking back, I didn't think it really affected me. A decade on road policing, covering the county's roads and motorways, provided an education on every which way a human being can lose their life, some less pleasant than others. In hindsight, it was the FLO work that I did that caused the most trauma, a role that definitely got harder, not easier, as the years went on. It was the utter heart-numbing tragedy that always accompanied these incidents. Telling a wife that her husband had been killed, and then turning off the gas to the pan of soup that was gently simmering on the stove for his dinner. Telling a mother her young son had been killed, and the wail of utter grief that once heard you never ever forget. The list goes on and on and on. More recently, my work on child protection, where sexual abuse had destroyed a young family. The trauma of the investigation was for the children, worse than what had actually happened to them. Managing their trauma and their mother's was emotionally exhausting. Finally, bereavement. It's an event at the back of all our minds we know we will have to face at some time in our lives. Not only is it distressing, it reminds us of our own mortality. I lost my mother in 2013, where she died in my arms. My father died alone many years earlier, and I vowed that that would never happen again. My mother's second husband, my stepfather, was also there when she died. He never got over it, and as a former amateur champion cyclist, he would go out on his bike every day to keep his own demons at bay. In 2021, he also died alone. He'd been taking medication for his arthritis for many years. It caused his lungs to scar, and in the space of 6 months, went from cycling 50 miles a day to being bedridden, on oxygen, and requiring carers, five times a day. Once again, life showed its ugly side, taking away the one remaining thing that made him happy. Although I wasn't that close to him, I suppose the last remaining link to my mother had died, which reignited the trauma of her death. I suppose I was grieving for both of them. These three things came together all at once. I knew I could no longer pretend. I knew I could no longer go on. I was broken and lost to myself. I typed an email to my first and second line supervisors. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. I explained my circumstances and said that I wouldn't be coming into work. I felt ashamed and guilty for letting the organisation and my teammates down. It was to be 6 months before I finally returned to work. In the days leading up to me going off, I was dealing with the funeral arrangements for my stepdad. He wasn't a religious man, but spiritually curious. I had to write the service and choose the music that reflected him. The final song, as everybody left the crematorium, was Take It Easy by the Eagles. One of the lines from that song, "Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy," were to be relevant in the coming weeks. I have told countless families dealing with bereavement that the funeral is the first milestone encountered to closure, and for me, it was no different. Days of intense planning and legal discussions were now coming to an end. They had been a sad distraction. Now what? Being alone in my house with just my dog for company during the day, without any other human connection, meant I was alone with myself. The only thing to think about was my thoughts, and that is a vicious circle. If you were to look at my work diary prior to going off, it would have been full of appointments, tasks, and reminders. I was later to discover that I was suffering from high-functioning anxiety, although it is not a recognised mental health diagnosis. On the surface, I was juggling several complex jobs, hitting deadlines, and in control. High-achieving and a perfectionist with a keen eye for detail, always willing to help others and take on difficult cases. The other side of me, however, was a completely different story entirely. A people pleaser, fear of being a bad friend or work colleague, of letting people down, constantly overthinking and the need for reassurance, always dwelling on the negative and an inability to set boundaries, which in work meant never saying no. Physically, this led to insomnia, feeling nauseous and fatigue. It never occurred to me that I had an anxiety disorder. After all, we are all in a high-pressure role. The front line is now in every office, and most people outside the police station have little comprehension of our roles, and even less capacity to carry them out. I thought it was normal, and that everybody else felt the same as me. My first counselling session arranged by Occupational Health was hard and upsetting. My counsellor, a wonderful woman, quite unexpectedly asked me why I became a police officer. I gave the usual answer that I wanted to help people, which of course was true. She kept on going at me though, "Yes, Dave, but why?" We talked for nearly an hour, not letting me off the hook. My thoughts about my parents and my unhappy childhood prevailed. Then she said, "Dave, not only were you not heard as a child, you were dismissed. You became a police officer for recognition." Her words hit me hard as any punch, and I don't think I've cried as hard as I did since I was a child. And in hindsight, it was probably the child crying. Thankfully, I can talk about such things now quite openly and calmly. A sign at least that I am in a much better place. Over the coming weeks, I had a further 7 sessions before then starting a course of therapy with a counsellor provided by my GP. The first set of counselling was about how I got to the place I had and why. The second set was how I could move on from that place. I found out that perspective and courage are essential ingredients to getting to a better place. I started to do work with the Curtis Palmer Programme, a charity set up to help serving and retired blue light workers come to terms with their demons. They use the Special Forces ethos of always a little further, the unrelenting pursuit of excellence, and being able to laugh at your own misfortune. Through the charity, I've been wild camping, spent a week in Snowdonia, and climbing, undergone dynamic breathing and cold water swimming, and I've been on a weekend retreat in the Peak District with several other officers from other forces. It is fair to say I've made lifelong friends through our shared adversity, but this isn't the vulnerable leading the vulnerable. We became strong in our own individual ways. They say you can't get better in the environment that made you ill, and that is true. It was time for me to return to work. I had a half-hour interview with a marvellous lady from Occupational Health. When I read her report on me, I was surprised to learn that in medical terms, I probably fell under the Disability Act due to the trauma I had experienced. I sat down with my supervisor and we put together a return to work plan. I could no longer take on the responsibility of looking after the trauma of others. The danger was that I would end up right back in the place I had been. I started slowly at first with just a few hours a day. The organisation had made work adjustments for me, which I am very grateful for, and it was my aspiration in the few months remaining to me before I retired to use that experience to help my work colleagues with their workload. Finally, I will try and explain what I've learned about myself, what worked, and some inescapable truths. There are in no particular order, except perhaps the most important one of all, which I will leave until last. What works for me may not work for you. We are all different. There are 1,000 different ways to suffer trauma, and 1,000 different ways to be vulnerable to it, and 1,000 different ways to get back to a better place. I'm not a religious person, but as I get older, I find myself becoming more spiritual. So here goes. Change. It is everywhere and in everything, and it never stops. Even your own body is replacing itself as you listen to this. New stars are born from the remnants of dead ones, and you can see the circle of life in the seasons of the weather. It is the law of the universe. So then, as the good times won't last forever, neither will the bad. I am becoming used to change because it is the one constant in life. I still suffer from anxiety and depression, and occasionally I have a bad day. I now know that this will not last indefinitely. I am not responsible for my trauma, although for a long time I thought I was. I am, however, responsible for my recovery. Seneca said, "No man jumps in the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and he is not the same man." Mindfulness. My anxiety means it's difficult to get in the present moment. Thinking about the past leads to depression, and worrying about the future leads to anxiety. Neither the past nor future exist in this moment. I found mindfulness helps me tremendously. I use hill walking, cold water therapy, and most recently Tai Chi to help me get there. Part of Tai Chi teaches you to look at everything as though it was the first time you've seen it. It's hard to do and needs practice, but as you begin to master the technique, the world becomes a different place entirely. Try the practice yourself with an object before moving on to your friends, the people you care for, and finally yourself. When you think about it, we as police investigators do this regularly. The most elusive facts are often the ones staring you in the face, and there is no greater impediment to clear sight than a lifetime worth of bias and prejudice. I realise that I'm not going to master the rest of my life in one day. I just try to master it one day at a time. You cannot get better in the place that made you ill, and I could never have returned to work unless the organisation had made adjustments to my work responsibilities. The only other option would have been to leave. Part of my trauma was work-related, and in one of my counselling sessions, I was shocked to be told that my trauma would never leave me. But what I could do was change my view of it, and not let it be the all-pervading experience it had previously been. It's been hard work, and in my experience, the only way is to talk it out. If we avoid it, we will never achieve the inner peace we are searching for. Perspective is everything. It shapes how you feel, and how you feel is everything to you. Feelings, however, are not reliable indicators of a situation you may find yourself in. Fatigue and loneliness are powerful motivators to thinking the worst. I still find it hard to pull myself out of that sinking sound of thinking. But I look for perspective in my own previous experiences, when nothing bad actually happened, and the advice and experience and friendship of others. Boundaries. Setting them is one of the hardest things to do when you're a diagnosed people pleaser. I try to remind myself that no is a complete sentence. There is an old saying in the military that battle plans are torn up on first contact with the enemy. I was anxious that my return to work program and the proposed adjustments to my working experience would fly out the window once back at my desk. The biggest antidote to those feelings was my head of department, who welcomed me back and stressing how important it was that I made it clear if I felt uncomfortable with a task. After 10 weeks back at work, battle plan is still holding, as is my nerve. And finally, us, we, you and me. Love yourself, not in a mirror sort of way. At every turn in my mental health journey, whether it has been counsellors, work supervisors or occupational health, it has been put yourself first, Dave. This feels so selfish and self-centred. It's hard to accommodate the idea. What makes it worse is that you must love yourself unconditionally. But more than that, put yourself above your parents, your partner, and even your children. I doubt few of us will be ever able to truly do this. The Dalai Lama says love and compassion are the pillars of world peace, and if we are to find our own peace and be the best that we can be for those we care about the most, it has to come from inside ourselves. You can't find happiness in a relationship without first finding it in yourself. You may take the other person hostage to your own trauma, and that is entirely selfish. I will never be the same person I was before events transpired, but I may be just a little bit better for it in the long run. I kept a journal in the 6 months I was away from work, and I continued to do so. And in August 2021, I wrote the following down. I didn't know where it came from and I didn't realise its importance at the time. There is a time when it is necessary to abandon the used clothes which have already have the shape of our body and to forget our paths which take us always to the same places. This is the place to cross the river, and if we don't dare do it, we will have stayed forever beneath ourselves. As Max Ehrman said in 1927, when he wrote the world-famous poem Desiderata. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. Strive to be happy.
DCT Audio. The Art of Good Listening.